what has been presented now is the fact that the United States has sufficient force and it need not justify its action.
What I want to tell America now is please, please, please respect others.
I don't think America is going to be with the Iraqi people in their life dealing. They wanted only to occupy Iraq, to take the oil, as it seems up to now.
We in Latin America, we are not confused about who the U.S. is. My country was invaded. Dominican Republic was invaded. They supported Saddam Hussein, and they created Bin Laden during the Cold War.
This is Pacifica's Peace Watch for Monday, May 5th, 2003. I'm Verna Avery Brown. The Bush administration has admitted that Saddam Hussein probably had no weapons of mass destruction. According to an article in the Sunday Herald of Scotland, senior officials in the Bush administration have admitted that they would be amazed if weapons of mass destruction were found in Iraq. According to administration sources, Saddam Hussein shut down and destroyed large parts of his WMD programs before the invasion of Iraq. All this against the backdrop, as recently as last week, of President-elect George Bush claiming Saddam Hussein had weapons of mass destruction and vowing that we will find them. David McMichael is with Veteran Intelligence Professionals for Sanity, or VIPS. It's a group made up of former spies for the CIA and FBI who say the Bush administration should be embarrassed over their failure to produce the smoking gun. We asked McMichael how important it is that they find weapons of mass destruction at this point, now that the military phase of the war is virtually over.
The general opinion, of course, of the people and the major media in the United States is that the ends of the United States are good, and therefore we should pay little attention to the means. And this, I think, one could prove historically. The political fallout in the United Kingdom will be much more severe for the future of Mr. Tony Blair and the current group that controls the Labour Party if they are unable to present a credible evidence of the existence, and not only the existence of programs for this, but significant amounts of these weapons and means for their delivery, because there's great anger being expressed, as you know, in the House of Commons even now.
Well, Tony Blair actually operates under a different system, obviously, and he's already under attack by Labour backbenchers who say that there is no smoking gun and that the war against Iraq, which Bush and Blair centered on claims that Saddam was a risk to Britain and America and the Middle East because of these unconventional weapons, that war was unjustified. And just how costly might this be for Blair? Could he not be voted out of office as a result if weapons of mass destruction are found?
Very, very easily. And, of course, while I don't claim to be, expert on the minutiae of the British system, there are certain critical votes which are votes of confidence in the House of Commons, which can be called. Secondly, when it comes to vote a budget, if the controlling party does not carry its budget, it must resign and call for new elections.
So President Bush is not going to pay any political costs for this, in your opinion?
I have not noticed that in the past any American president who has been revealed as being less than candid with the Congress or the people of the United States on the evidence by which he chose to carry the United States into a war has paid any significant political price for that. The senior Mr. Bush, of course, was revealed very soon after the Gulf War in 1991 to have, to put it bluntly, lied egregiously about the situation vis-a-vis Kuwait on significant matters, and when his popularity remained very high until, of course, the economic collapse a year later, which did cost him the election. But I think we have a long Cold War history of the and as you know, as former intelligence officers, as we in VIPS are, you know, we are well aware of the use of false evidence, even the planting of evidence, you know, to justify to the public U.S. actions. And when these were revealed, there's never been any particular public outcry about it.
So Bush Sr. and Bush George W. notwithstanding, are there any previous presidents who blatantly lied about the reasons for going into a war?
In the case of Vietnam, the most flagrant thing, of course, was the Tonkin Gulf incident, which, as Daniel Ellsberg, and among many others, tells us, the circumstances were well known, that there had been no such attack as represented by President Johnson. This was known to Johnson before he presented his resolution to the Congress, which was the exception of two votes, you know, one by Wayne Morse, the late Wayne Morse, carried and led us into that destructive conflict. I think on a smaller scale, for example, one could look at the Bay of Pigs situation, in which the United States used the Alabama Air National Guard to bomb the Cuban Air Force bases, B-26 bombers. And when the Cuban ambassador complained in the United Nations about this, poor Adlai Stevenson, our ambassador, who was had been lied to by the White House, said, no, no, those were defecting Cuban Air Force pilots. And within 2 days, of course, since two of the planes were shot down in Havana and others had to land in Miami, it was clear that these, in fact, were not Cuban planes. Mm. But this did not seem to disturb those who went on and carried out the Bay of Pigs operation, the subsequent activities against Cuba, which continue to this very day.
Mm-hmm. So is it the senior U.S. officials in the Bush administration that added that America never expected to find this huge arsenal are also arguing that the administration was more concerned about the ability of Saddam's scientists, which he labeled the nuclear mujahideen, in terms of developing weapons of mass destruction when the crisis passed. What does it say about the political climate in this country that this official would feel comfortable enough to make these statements to the press? Is it possible the administration is deliberately leaking this information?
I would say it's more than possible. And I think the rationale underlying all this, of course, is the need for quote-unquote regime change in the region. It's the I think it's stated, of course, very blatantly by those surrounding Secretary of Defense Rumsfeld, and are now publishing in such places as the New York Times Magazine apologetics for the establishment of an American empire. You know, we need not have any particular rationale for this, supported by direct evidence. And, you know, in institutional terms, it represents this ongoing struggle between the State Department on one hand and the Department of Defense on the other, with the Central Intelligence Agency playing a sidelines role as to who is actually in control of United States policy. And the Pentagon, of course, and I think very important elements of those, the Wolfowitzes and Armitages and so forth, mm-hmm. who are associated with that, were very, very happy to see what amounts to the destruction of the United Nations, that as the United States, in violation of Article 51, undertook what could only be considered in law an aggression against Iraq. And this, of course, is not to, you know, as is necessary to say, to defend the atrocious nature of Saddam Hussein, the Ba'ath Party, and just about anything else you mm-hmm. want to mention. But the point is that not only did the administration go ahead and take these actions, which effectively, I believe, has destroyed the United Nations, but one of my keenest regrets is that the Secretary General of the United States Nations, Kofi Annan, simply rolled over and died and accepted this without any effective protest or denunciation. So what we can look for in the future with the United Nations mm-hmm. as a stand against this American imperialism, if you will, is questionable.
What about the precedent this has set, that preemptive action is now justified against a nation like Iraq that simply has the potential ability to develop unconventional weapons?
Well, justification, there has nothing to do with it. What has been presented now is the fact that the United States has sufficient force and it need not justify its actions. And I think this is what's significant in this matter of apparent acceptance that, well, discovery of the advanced justification, that is the stores of these weapons of mass destruction, isn't necessary at all.
David McMichael is with Veteran Intelligence Professionals for Sanity, or VIPS, a group made up of former spies for the CIA and FBI. Despite the humanitarian crisis brought on by 12 years of economic sanctions compounded by the recent war, life for some Iraqis is returning to a state of semi-normalcy, perhaps. Peace Watch reporter Raphael Kraft recently visited a school in Baghdad where students are returning to their classrooms for the first time since the bombing began.
Wartime vacations are over for students at Baghdad College High School. The 70-year-old Jesuit school where Saddam Hussein's son, Uday, studied has reopened its door after 2 months of closure because of the war. When the Iraqi army fled the school on the 10th of April, looters entered it for 24 hours until the American army moved in. Salmat Fawzi is the dean of the school.
All the doors were damaged, especially in the administration building and the laboratories also. And all the stores, computers and laboratory equipments and refrigerators and televisions. And
Who do you think did that?
Somebody entered the school and have stolen everything.
Do you blame the American army for that?
No.
Do you have enough facilities today to actually start the school?
Yes, nearly. We can start today. And tomorrow we can start perfectly.
But like many other schools in Baghdad, most students are still at home. Parents feel letting their kids leave the house as anarchy continues to reign in the streets of the Iraqi capital. The shortage of available fuel makes it difficult for student transportation. And it doesn't look like the situation will be better before the end of the school term. And many think the school term might be cancelled. Still, there were a few hundred students here greeting each other after weeks of wondering about the fate of their comrades during the war. Ali and Ragdan's main concern is the final school exam at the end of the year.
I want to go back to school and complete our examinations because we want to complete our study. We mustn't stay in this case. It is a very terrible situation.
It's my last year here and then go to university. But we don't think that we'll go to university. The examination, final examination, we wait for it.
You have been working during the war?
No. We can't do anything. It's war. You said it.
For over two decades, Saddam Hussein had been at the center of learning in an Iraqi public school. Even after the American victory, his picture remains in every book. His life is part of the history curriculum. His novels studied in literature class. But Ragdan says the students haven't been fooled at all by the regime's propaganda.
Everything we studied was lies and lies. All lies. Just lies. We didn't understand anything from it. Saddam Hussein, Abdul Majid, Kala, son of the prince of Kirkuk, and son of the king.
So now, what do you expect from the future in the school?
I think it's a good future. Wait for us. Wait for the next generation of us. We got to university now. That's the next generation, I think it's good.
Do you think the Americans will have a big influence in the school here?
I think so.
Do you think it's good?
Yeah.
Why?
Because they have us. They liberate us from Saddam.
Like Ragdan, most of the students dream of studying in the United States or Europe, and the enthusiasm they expressed on Saturday may obscure the realities they will confront in the near future. Rafa Rasu is the head of the English department at Baghdad College. He doesn't think America will have any influence in Iraq's future education programs.
I don't think America is going to be with the Iraqi people in their life dealing. No, I have been to the States. I have been to New York. And I found that the Americans are not involved in everything. They wanted only to occupy Iraq, to take the oil, as it seems up to now. And that's all.
But America will have some role in designing the future curriculum. The dean of Baghdad College told Pacifica the U.S. Army has appointed a team of 16 Iraqis to do that job as part of a provisional Ministry of Education. The goal is that next year there will be a new curriculum in Iraq schools. Although the American Army says it has provided schools with minesweepers to clear the weapons the Iraqi army had left while occupying the schools, there is still an Iraqi missile and its launcher in the courtyard of Baghdad College. The students are playing on it, and nobody knows how and when it will be removed. For Pacifica's Peace Watch, I'm Raphael Kraft in Baghdad.
The U.S. announced late last week that it plans to divide Iraq into three sections under U.S., British, and Polish command. Though military operations have officially ceased, the long-term occupation of Iraq is only just beginning. That's according to Peace Watch commentators Ralph Schoenman and Maya Schoen, who worry that we're now entering a state of permanent and never-ending war.
President Bush last Thursday, appearing on the USS aircraft carrier Abraham Lincoln, sent a message to the world, as well as to people here in the United States, that the U.S. was engaged in permanent war. He said, "Friend and foe alike, our nation has a mission. We will answer threats to our security, and we will defend the peace."
By that, he means that he will intervene at will, and he specifies that there are something like 60 countries which are candidates for this preemptive and permanent war which U.S. rulers require. But, Maya, one of the interesting things about these plans for a condition of permanent war and the subsequent repression in the United States, that with respect to Iraq, the London Times on May 3rd made clear that that old Oded Yinon plan, the Mossad plan that was taken up by Wolfowitz and Pearl in the National Security Council in the late 1970s, that plan to carve Iraq into three pieces, ethnic and religious components of the Ottoman Empire, is alive and well. Here's the London Times, May 3rd. Bush plans to carve Iraq into three sectors, and six European countries have been enlisted and have agreed to provide the troops that will supplement the 135,000 U.S. troops already in Iraq.
And for the countries around the world, appearing on the Lincoln was not just a whim of the moment. It was the aircraft carrier Abraham Lincoln, from which the U.S. dropped nearly 1.2 million pounds of high explosives on Iraq. And after the Abraham Lincoln, the very next day, President Bush appeared at United Defense Industry, the California manufacturer of the Bradley fighting vehicle, major shares of which are owned by the Carlyle Group, of which his father, the former President Bush, has enormous shares.
It's a virtual who's who of the current administration, with Rumsfeld and Ashcroft and all of the crony capitalists on board Carlyle. It's a little scratch-your-back imperial operation that subjects the peoples of the world to mass misery, permanent war, the hallmark of the U.S. ruler's plan for the globe.
So when President Bush says, quote, "Our coalition will stay until our work is done in Iraq, then we will leave and leave behind a free Iraq," what he means, loud and clear, is privatized and controlled by U.S. corporate interests.
And as the Times said, the 135,000 U.S. soldiers will be supplemented by the other nations' troops, carving them up into three sectors. It's going to be a colonial operation as originally planned.
This is
Ralph Schoenman
and Maya Schoen.
Ralph and Maya are co-hosts of Taking Aim, which airs on Pacifica station WBAI in New York. Secretary of State Colin Powell on Sunday backed off comments he had made a day earlier that Syria has begun closing offices of groups that the United States considers terrorist organizations. Powell went on to say that, quote, "We would be watching and we would measure performance over time to see whether Syria is prepared now to move in a new direction," end quote. We go now to Scott C. Davis, author of The Road from Damascus, A Journey Through Syria, speaking to students from the Syrian Virtual University. SVU is a state-sponsored university based in Damascus that enrolls students in online courses from accredited universities primarily in the U.S. and Europe. Their views on the war on Iraq represent the views of many Syrians.
The American media portrays Syrians as radicals who swarmed into Iraq for the pleasure of killing American soldiers. Yet 99.9% of Syrians were calm, sincere, and exceedingly nonviolent in their response to the war. The night the war started, I was in Damascus. I walked into an ancient stone cathedral in the old city. The place was packed with men and women and young children. While the bombs dropped, Syrians prayed. A day later, I took a taxi to the modern end of town and visited the Syrian Virtual University in a newly refurbished building near the Sheraton Hotel. Amidst the rows of computer terminals, I spoke with students at this state-sponsored institution. The bombs were still dropping in Baghdad, yet none of these students shouted threats to an American or vowed revenge. Instead, they responded with questions and quiet reasoning.
My feeling is very terrible right now to see and to hear about many people are dying for no perfect or good reason. It's just like madness. And I hope that someone find the reason why this war is happening right now.
I think that we were and you were crying for the people who killed in September 11. So why the American now kills the people in Iraqis? And for the weapons, I think America have the most weapons, the most number, very huge number of weapons, more than any other country. So I don't think there's any reason for killing people in Iraq.
I wish all the wars will stop, because the war is not the best thing we make it. We can negotiate, we can make everything else without the war. So why America is fighting Iraq? Why?
Why don't you tell me what your hopes are for your country in the years ahead?
I hope that we'll get the electronic government, the computers will be in every school, every university, every ministry. Okay, that's
about my country. My country will have a lot of technology and companies, big companies.
Our country will be an advanced and good country, but if we get out of this war near us.
For me, it's not just hopes, it's my beliefs, what I believe my country will be. I believe that my country will get over all those bad years we spent. Over the war, there was problems, there was a lot of things happening. I think we'll get over all what happened, and we will get advanced. We will have the technology implemented in Syria, all over Syria, in all sectors. And I believe in that, but this is a duty that we have to take, and we have to do our jobs to make our country proud of us. I believe that Syria will be advanced very, very soon.
A day later, I was in central Damascus when an anti-war march came toward me. I saw a couple hundred young men and women, a few hand-painted signs, and two young men, one sitting atop the other's shoulders. They shouted a chant. The whole thing was very low-key. As the marchers walked past, I noticed something strange about the crowd. Every second person was talking on a cell phone. Syrians seemed absorbed in their personal lives and in love with cell phones, satellite TV, and computer games. They wanted good jobs, a good future, and feared that the war would impede the progress their country was making. Still, they sensed that something was deeply wrong. With the Iraq War, a pillar of their world had fallen. They had lost a champion and found themselves standing alone. Following World War I, Middle Eastern Arabs in Syria, Lebanon, and Palestine had been polled. What foreign power would you choose to oversee the transition of the region to self-rule and democracy? The poll asked. Arabs were deeply suspicious of the traditional colonial powers such as Britain and France, so they chose the United States, itself a colony that had broken free. Unfortunately, the poll was not a vote and had no legal effect. Still, since that time, Arabs have looked to the U.S. to uphold standards of international conduct, reason, law, fairness, self-determination. The United States had principles. It had wisdom. It never acted on impulse. It was the definition of class and made dictators look petty, foolish, self-interested, laughable. It made local tyrants look like yesterday's men. The United States had been the gold standard against which international behavior was judged. Nowadays, young Syrians were slightly embarrassed to be delivering to Americans the same lectures that Americans had for many years been delivering to citizens of third world countries. I remembered in particular the comments of one young man I had met at the Syrian Virtual University the night before.
My heart is bleeding for every single baby being killed, for every woman losing her sons, her daughters, anyone losing his father, for anyone going to sleep without having his dinner. My heart's bleeding for all the guys or people whom are dying just right now in Iraq and in many other places of the world because of this war madness. War will not bring us anywhere. We have to talk. We have brains. We are humans. We are not animals. We don't fight to get our things done. We have to negotiate, to talk to each other, understand each other. What I want to tell America now is, please, please, please respect others. That's it.
Scott C. Davis has traveled extensively in Syria. He is author of The Road from Damascus, A Journey Through Syria.
Songs are amazing things. They allow us to raise our voices in pain, in praise, and in protest.
It's such a strange time.
In pain and in protest.
It's such a strange time.
Pain and protest.
Such a strange time.
And we live in fictitious times. We live in the time where we have fictitious election results that elects a fictitious president. We live in a time where we have a man sending us to war for fictitious reasons, whether it's the fictitious of duct tape or the fictitious of orange alerts. We are against this war, Mr. Bush. Shame on you, Mr. Bush. Shame on you.
Pain and protest.
You know, my experiences in making this film.
A musical montage from Peter Beauchamp, producer of All Mixed Up at Pacifica Station WBAI in New York City. I'm Verna Avery Brown. You're listening to Peace Watch. We'll be back in a moment.